Wilberforce, Ohio is a historical landmark for black Americans. Named in honor of the great 18th century abolitionist William Wilberforce, its roots date back to 1884. From the founding of the university, its task was unmistakably clear. Its students were escaped and freed slaves who would become the leadership core of the not yet emancipated black population. The nation's first black college, Wilberforce University, set its mission as the preparation of black men and women for the difficulties of a complex world. In honor of its accomplishments, residents of Ohio felt it would be an appropriate spot to build a national Afro-American museum, and this triggered off what has long been a controversial issue in Ohio and the U.S. Congress. It began more than a decade ago, when citizens of Ohio started petitioning the state legislature for the National Afro-American Museum. In response to their pleas, U.S. Representative Clarence Brown introduced a bill in 1968. The bill stated that a federally chartered Afro-American museum should be established. State Representative C.J. McClin followed suit and introduced a bill to the Ohio General Assembly. That bill called for state sponsorship of the museum and was passed in June of 1972. The bill authorized the Ohio Historical Society to establish and operate a museum in the vicinity of Wilberforce. The same bill also created a planning council whose duties were to advise the Historical Society in developing the project. The council was to consist of 15 members, each serving 4-year terms. C.J. McClin was appointed to head the council in 1973, but was later replaced by Charles Taylor, president of Wilberforce, in 1979. The council labored on the museum project for a couple of years, achieving little progress. People began to wonder just how effective the planning council was. Charles Taylor seemed to think the reason for the council's stagnation during that period was due to the absence of professional council members.
I think what held the project up at the state level was the fact that the planning council itself labored for a number of years trying to piece the plans together for this museum when really in the absence of a professional staff. And it really was not until funds were made available by the state to secure a professional planning staff that things really got off the mark.
Things looked a little brighter, though, in 1976. Through the joint efforts of Congressman Brown and Senator Glenn, U.S. Congress passed legislation directing the Secretary of the Interior to conduct a feasibility suitability study of the museum. The study was to include cost estimates for necessary acquisitions, development, operations, and maintenance, as well as alternatives for administration of the museum. The study was concluded in 1978 and found Wilberforce to be a well-suited place for the project. At that point in time, the museum seemed to be shaping into a reality, but shortly after the feasibility study was completed, tensions began to flare within the planning council. It appeared several members of the council were uncertain of the capabilities of the acting executive secretary, Douglas Russell. After the majority of the council voted in August of 1979 to fire Doug Russell, Charles McClin, council president, opposed the firing and failed to pass the recommendation on to the Ohio Historical Society. He later commented that he did not realize the recommendation was a final action. McClin recommended Russell's hiring when the planning council was formed and said the museum was a dead issue until he and Russell brought it back to life.
I always have maintained that it wasn't nobody but Doug and I, and we brought it from sudden failure that the Historical Society people say, well, it's no use to be fooling with that. That's dead. We worked on it, brought it back to life. There wasn't nobody working but him. So if any success to take it there, I think he had to do it, and I just felt that he didn't deserve the negative remarks that he received for not performing his duty. Some of the newer people wanted to flex their muscles. After all, I was a Democrat, and the board had become almost majority Republican. And I guess they weren't going to let a Democrat tell us what to do when they had the power.
Some of the reasons cited by council members in recommending Russell's firing include his action to raise his own salary over a 3-year period from $16,785 to $26,208 annually. But Charles Taylor, now president of the council, contends that the salary issue wasn't the main reason for Russell's firing.
That issue really was not a matter of any personal dissension among the council. It was just a difference of opinion between a majority of the council and a minority of the council in terms of whether or not a particular individual was capable of producing for the council what needed to be produced. Then the judgment of the majority of the council, he was not producing the level of performance that was needed to move this project along. I'm not saying that he didn't make a contribution at some point in time, but conditions and situations change, and things evolve to a point where different skills and abilities are needed. We just didn't have that in Mr. Russell.
In August of 1979, as if it was inevitable, the museum was dealt a major setback. The Federal Office of Management and Budget had decided to oppose plans to build the federally funded National Black Museum. The management office maintained that the Smithsonian Institute in Washington is the national museum, and as a matter of policy, they do not support museums outside of the Smithsonian or outside of Washington. Both President Taylor and C.J. McGlynn disagreed with the decision, but felt the setback could be overcome.
And I think that more than a reaction to the concept itself, it was a reaction to the economic times that we find ourselves in. And OMB felt that what was being proposed was within the jurisdiction of something that already existed, namely the complex of national museums on the Mall, operated principally by the Smithsonian. But that's not what we were talking about, and it was, in my judgment, a mistake on the part of OMB, but people make mistakes all the time, and that certainly will not stop the project.
I don't agree with it, but I can accept it. We got museums all over the country, and for instance, the Air Force Museum, it don't have to be in Washington, it don't have to be in the Smithsonian neither. But I can accept it if they want to put it that way. Main thing, if we can get a center to have a centralized housing and a center for Afro-American contributions, I don't have no fault with the center.
On October 10th, 1980, Congress passed Public Law 96-430, a bill sponsored and fought for by Congressman Clarence Brown and Senator John Glenn. The bill called for Congress to establish a 15-member national commission, which would begin planning for the National Afro-American Museum and Cultural Center. On October 12, 1980, former President Jimmy Carter signed that legislation into law. So the museum has come a long way since its early planning days, and rightly so, because it's taken quite a bit of time to get this far. Now it's just a matter of appropriating federal funds to get the museum built. But at the present time, says Taylor, that doesn't seem likely.
All that exists now is authorization legislation. The Congress passed a law saying that a national commission should be established to set up a National Museum of Afro-American History and Culture at Wilberforce, Ohio. That's all it says.
Right.
And that the federal government should appropriate X number of million dollars for that. Doesn't say that at all. Since there is no appropriation bill, there is no bill that says the Congress shall appropriate $17 million for this project.
Don't you expect to have that bill in the future?
Not in any time soon. We'll have to work through existing programs and hope, like the Dickens, that the economy improves to such a point where the government can again turn its attention to other things that will improve the quality of life in this country, such as museums and things that have to do with the arts and other things. I support that. I wouldn't be in favor of an appropriation bill at this point in time. We've got thousands of Americans out of work, and our economy has taken a nosedive, and this is just not the priority at the moment.
With the museum project taking such a long time, one might wonder if there's any outside interference involved. Taylor admits there is opposition to the program, but none that would actually damage the museum's progress.
There are other facilities around the country who perceive this to be an attempt to supplant their efforts. And that's just a misunderstanding that we will have to work with people to attempt to correct. What we've got to explain to people is that we're not talking about establishing the National Museum of Afro-American History and Culture. We're talking about establishing a National Museum of Afro-American History and Culture. We're not talking about supplanting any of the existing facilities. What we're trying to do is to supplement those efforts and to provide a place which allows all of the existing facilities to do things that they haven't been able to do in the past. And so there are some real advantages to having a national center that attempts to build a network of existing facilities and provide services. Of course, there are always going to be people who are going to say, the thing should have been in Atlanta. You know, I mean, that's the home of Dr. Martin Luther King and kind of the symbol of Black American progress, et cetera, and it ought to be Atlanta. The only other opposition that I can think of will be some fiscal opposition that some people will argue that we simply shouldn't be spending money.
Public opinion toward the museum has gone up and down over the years, and sometimes slacken off to a point where many had given up hope. But Taylor says the public has become very supportive of late. The recent developments in the project have rekindled a flame which could finally turn the museum issue into a reality.
I think that people were getting frustrated and people wanted to see something happen, but just in the last 3 weeks, or last 2 weeks, whenever it was we held the press conference in Columbus, public opinion has zoomed very high again. Everybody's saying, wow, you know, I thought this thing was dead, but you know, it's not dead, and somebody is working on it, and things are happening, but nothing will help this project as much as the sooner we can bring a bulldozer and some guys with hammer and nails, and we go out here in front and put up a sign, and that bulldozer starts digging a hole. Nothing really cements things in people's consciousness the way an actual facility does. I think we're probably within 24 months of that.
Taylor says the museum will strengthen the Wilberforce community. It will essentially put this small, undeveloped town on the map. One of the main factors Taylor sees in the project is the possibilities of commercial interest in the Wilberforce vicinity.
There is the whole business that for Greene County that I think that the museum represents. And that's what this facility will represent in the way of new commercial development. This is a very unusual college town in that there's nothing here other than the colleges themselves. In most college towns, you find those kinds of things in support of the college population that exists there. And there are literally millions of dollars flowing annually from here into Xenia. We need to find a way to bring some of those resources back into the community. The museum will help do that.
And so at this stage in time, it is yet another waiting period. But most council officials expect this to be the final waiting period. And after all, the citizens of Ohio have waited this long. Hopefully, they'll be able to wait a little longer. For the WYSO News, I'm Brian McCormick.